National Gallery podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and this is the National Gallery podcast. In this month's episode, the director of the gallery, Nicholas Penny, explains why picture frames deserve more attention than they normally get. And as the days grow shorter, we look to Turner for a little extra sun. But we start with news of our autumn exhibition, The Sacred Made Real, which opens on the 21st of this month. The show brings together paintings and painted wooden sculptures by some of the greatest masters of 17th century Spanish art. Few of these works have been seen outside Spain, and by way of a preview, Leah Caribbean visited the National Museum of Sculpture in northern Spain to find out about a sculpture that, when it arrives in London, looks set to be a star of the show.
Here I am in the historic city of Valladolid in northern Spain to meet Xavier Bray, the National Gallery's curator of The Sacred Made Real. He's here filming one of the sculptures that will be coming to the show, which is housed in the really very beautiful surroundings of the old medieval college de San Gregorio, which is now the National Museum of Sculpture. And I'm just going to come through this magnificent carved gateway and through a courtyard, and hopefully I'll find Xavier inside. Well, I've come up into the galleries, and there are some film lights up ahead, so I've come to the right place. That's the sculpture that Xavier's filming. Well, how to describe her? She's full height, polychromed, obviously, so she's painted to look incredibly lifelike. She has wrapped around her what seems to be this extraordinary piece of rush matting that's knotted to form a dress, knotted about her waist with a rope. And she's got her hair loose over her shoulders, one hand pressed in distress almost against her chest, and in the other hand she's holding a crucifix at which she's staring. Let me see if I can find out more about her. Xavier, hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for seeing me. I wondered if you could start really by telling us who she is and who made her.
Well, it's Mary Magdalene posing as a penitent, and the person who made her is one of the greatest sculptors of 17th century Spain, Pedro de Mena, who sadly is completely unknown outside Spain, but in his day was recognised as one of the greatest sculptors around. He mainly worked in Malaga in southern Spain. Basically, he's used different bits of wood that he would have carved separately. He would have then united by sticking them with animal glue and nails. Then he would have covered her with white gesso and basically added colour to it. So for example, for the rush matting that makes up a...
And is that carved wood?
That is carved wood, yes. It looks like gesso, but actually when you get close to it, you can actually see the vein of the wood. So they're very thin sheets of wood that he would have carved and then put assembled together. And the rope, I mean, most people think it's actually real rope, but actually when you get close...
It's wood.
It is wood, yes.
That's extraordinary.
And the knot is something out of this world. And then it's the hair, that's the other thing. The top part has been carved on her head, but the actual long locks of hair are made out of wicker.
Like wicker work for
exactly.
You get in baskets.
Exactly, and that would have been gessoed and painted and stuck on with nails to the main part of her wig, let's say.
You make it all sound like sort of woodwork or something, you know, with nails and glue and stuff, but she completely is beyond all that. She is real, she is lifelike, and she looks so modern. I mean, she's like a Ron Muick or something.
Completely, and I mean, what does it is, I think, the glass eyes. I mean, as soon as the eyes have been inserted into her mask from behind, because that was carved separately and hollowed, and then these glass eyes that were painted from within were inserted, that suddenly brings life to her face and her expression. But it's also the polychromy, which Pedro de Mena did himself. He applies this beautiful sort of skin tones across her face, but also her arms. And then for the lips, he uses a very light sort of pinkish red. And around her eyes, the fact that she's been crying has made her eyes slightly reddish with, you know, the fact that the salt has affected the skin tones.
Oh, just extraordinary.
Those details are amazing. And then the teeth are made out of ivory. So it really makes it just lifelike. Of course, this kind of sculpture would shock a lot of people, particularly in the 19th century, when we admired Greek sculptures and sculpture without colour. But I think, hopefully, it is time now for people to reappreciate this kind of sculpture, which is coloured.
And she's coming to London. You must be thrilled.
It's a miracle in itself that she is coming to London. It's been very difficult to persuade lenders, and she particularly is very fragile. But it is amazing that such a masterpiece of sculpture should be coming to London to be appreciated by, hopefully, an audience who will have never seen anything like her before.
I think you can say that. I've never seen anything quite like this at all. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks to Xavier Bray. We'll return to The Sacred Made Real next month. Until then, you can find out more and book tickets in advance on our website, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Next, frames are a ubiquitous presence in galleries, but few of us know that they've often got an intriguing history in their own right. One man who does is Nicholas Penny, director of the National Gallery, and the author of a pocket guide on the subject. Leah Caribbean went to find out more.
Nick Penny and I are standing in room 9, one of the most palatial rooms of the National Gallery, surrounded by some of the collection's most grandiose works from 16th century Italy. Now, Nick, few people here, it has to be said, are looking at the frames surrounding the pictures, and I know that you think that they're fascinating objects and you'd like us all to take a closer look. But as beginners, where should we start?
Well, I think people are looking at them, even though they don't know they're looking at them, because frames affect the way you see a picture. They isolate the picture, they separate it from the things around it. And so that even if you don't know that you're affected by a frame, you probably are. And perhaps one question which one should always ask is, what colour really is this frame? Most people will say, well, it's gold, isn't it? And you can actually then point out that there are different colours to the gold. I don't just mean that the gold is often dirty or often tarnished or deliberately toned. I actually also mean the gold itself can be a different colour. And when one becomes alert to that, one also tends to become alert, more alert, to what gold does to the actual colours in the paintings themselves. It certainly and most obviously always makes blue more brilliant.
Blue.
And blue is a very important colour because it's the sky. You know, you like to know when you're in the sky. And blue is a very important colour because the Virgin Mary wears it and so on. But blues are always affected by gold, but so, of course, are in a different way, not by contrast, but by affinity. So are all the oranges and reds in a picture. They can seem more radiant, more jubilant or whatever, as a result of the gold frame.
Now, we're actually standing in front of a really very beautiful frame that surrounds a painting by Jacopo Bassano of the Good Samaritan helping the wayfarer who's been beset by thieves. And this is actually, quite interestingly, a very pale gold, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's a very beautiful gold. It's the original gilding. And it's a beautifully carved 17th century frame. Now, it's not the type of frame that Bassano would have had around his pictures, but it is an old Italian frame. It's a kind, actually, that a picture by an artist like Bassano would have acquired in the 17th century. So what we've got here is a great old painting and a great old frame, and they look well together. It's a type of frame which is fairly expensive now, and we don't have a special government grant for buying old frames. So we are dependent on private individuals who contribute to helping us to buy frames. This was bought by Dr. and Mrs. Horan for us. And they bought other frames for us, and we're very grateful to them. It's a very imaginative thing for a supporter of the gallery to do. It's a very ornamental frame. Every surface is carved, as you can see. Only after a while you realise that it contradicts one of the merely basic things about frames, which is a very important elementary structural purpose of enabling you to carry a picture around and protecting the picture, especially if the picture's got glass in it or something like that. Now, this frame is very, very vulnerable because it's got all these little points.
Oh, yes, I can see them, yeah.
Like the ends of tongues or shields, and then the little ends of leaves, these little points.
All around the edge.
All around the edge. And, of course, when we acquired the frame, it was in very good condition, but many of these were broken. They had to be restored in our framing workshop. It took ages. But it just reminds you that this designer was much, much more interested in the aesthetics of the frame than in the practical uses of frame making.
And are you hoping that in the future there will be more information available about frames in the gallery?
Well, both in the galleries and of course on the website, where it's perhaps easier to provide more information. I think it would be very good if we always told the public whether or not they're looking at the original frame. And in exceptional cases, it would be good if we're telling them that we're looking at a very important and beautiful frame.
Special thanks to Nicholas Penny. The National Gallery Pocket Guide to Frames is available from gallery shops and online at www.nationalgallery.co.uk. If you're missing the summer sun now winter's on its way, our final interview is for you. We tend to take the sun for granted in paintings, as we never do in life, skipping over it in the background to look at the scene it illuminates. But as Robert Mile, author of the cultural history Sunshine, explains, there's a fascinating story behind its representation in art.
I was writing a book about the sun and thought I'd investigate it in art. So I walked around the gallery one day and it struck me that really you didn't see the sun in the skies of art, not until the 17th century. You see things that kind of look like the sun, but they're not actually the sun. They're more sort of yellow discs, golden discs that serve another purpose, which is really there to kind of enhance divinity. The most obvious example of this is the halo, which is really just a kind of solar disk. It was used on pagan gods. The Roman god of the sun had this convention of when he was personified, he had this disk around his head to kind of show his golden rays. And that was just quite literally stripped the assets of that iconography, and was used in Christian iconography from then onwards. So that's where we get the halo from. But there's other examples as well, which is where the sun is quite literally the vehicle for divine presence, for divine manifestation in the terrestrial world. A good example of this is Treviso's painting, The Adoration of the Kings, from around 1524. It's quite a chaotic painting. It's got the Holy Family in the centre, but also a whole host of a great chaotic crowd of people that have come to, in a sense, to observe what's going on. But Holy Family are quite natural, and they're within this scene of everyday life. It could easily be by Bruegel, but in an Italian setting. But then, when you look above the horizon, there's this rather bizarre manifestation, which is something that looks like the sun, a great golden disc bursting through the skies, and a whole host, a whole heavenly host, looks like they've hitched a ride on it, like some vast solar surfboard that they've ridden into town on. It could easily be something from Monty Python.
I mean, it sort of seems completely disconnected with what's going on below, doesn't it? It does have a quite comedic aspect.
Well, it's quite surreal. The world, the naturalistic world, is depicted with reasonable fidelity. I mean, it's quite naturalistic. There's the laws of perspective. There's a lot of showing off of the new kind of tricks of art, if you will. And then there's this other world, the world above, which doesn't obey those rules. It obeys its own rules. I think that's very typical of the depiction of the skies before the 17th century. Before landscape painting, before people started painting landscape as a subject in its own right. The world was the world, and the heavens were the heavens. They were the skies, but they were also the heavens, this space where anything could happen. And I think the idea is that the sun is part of the heavens, so it's kind of distant and remote and still very, very godlike and awe-inspiring.
So what happens, Robert, as we move through the centuries? I mean, is that something that changes?
When you get when landscape comes into its own as a subject of art, the skies and also the sun starts to become more naturalistically represented, more recognisable as the sun rather than this kind of vehicle for divine manifestation.
So we're now in front of Turner's Ulysses deriding Polyphemus, and this was painted in 1829. Completely different depiction of the sun.
The thing about this painting is the sun is the most important thing that's going on there. I mean, what's interesting is the title indicates that this is history painting, which was considered at the time the most important genre and certainly the one you could charge the most money for. So he's depicting a scene from Homer's Odyssey, which tells how that Ulysses has blinded Polyphemus, he's tricked Polyphemus, and they're riding away, and he's now deriding him. He's kind of taunting him. But really, you'd be forgiven for not seeing that immediately and not being able to identify identify the principal actors in this drama. Polyphemus the Cyclops is this kind of lowering shape that's blending into the mountains over to the left, and Ulysses is very nearly lost in the crowd on the ship, a ship hanging all over with people, crowded with people, and you can just about make him out because he's depicted in red. But really, the real star of the show, the thing that really interested Turner, is this spectacular solar sunset over on the right-hand side, just above the horizon. And it really dominates the picture. Everything about the composition draws your eye towards this sunset. You've got the rocks and the brow of another ship there that really just frame it and draw your eye towards it. And really, you can see that's the thing that interested him most. And that's very typical of Turner, especially in the later paintings, and this is considered a turning point in that respect, where he became obsessed with this idea of depicting sunlight, making the intangible tangible. So really he uses the pretext of a history painting to start exploring that, and we see that in later paintings where he really, in a sense, abandoned the pretext of a different kind of genre and just started to study light and explore light and try and make sunlight tangible.
Thanks to Robert Mile. If you'd like to see Turner's Ulysses deriding Polyphemus in person, come along to the gallery. We're open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays, and you can visit the permanent collection free of charge. And don't forget, if you can't come in person, you can view all the paintings we've talked about online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for this month. Until next time, goodbye.